COM, LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro. COM, LP, Chapel Hill, and Carrboro, and I'm Dick Paddock, co-host of The Wake Up Call, presented by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Triangle Branch. Sitting across from me is longtime co-host Lorraine Hoyt, and she will go ahead and introduce our guest, who I will mention anyway, Michael Wade.
Good.
So go ahead.
Well, what's really kind of cool, hello, Michael. I'm glad you're here. Michael called into our show about a month ago. And
do you remember what I asked? I can't remember what the question
was. Well, I forget what it was. And then either at that point or later, no, I think right at that point, said he'd be interested in coming on the show and talking about economics. And we said, great, this instead, you know, we go and invite people each week usually and looking around for guests. And this was somebody who kind of stepped forward. And we were tickled. And Michael, it's been a little while, but we're really glad you're here.
Thank
Michael
you.
Wade.
You were going to ask me about my background. I have a disclaimer before I even open my mouth.
Okay.
I'm not an expert on economics. I don't have any degrees. I've never had a job involving economics. I'm just an interested person who...
A citizen who cares.
Yeah. And I started reading about economics in general and what I consider to be the inadequacies of the capitalistic system, gosh, probably 45 years ago when I was still an undergraduate. But more specifically, what I was going to talk about today, other than economics in general, is monetary reform and banking reform. And I knew zero about that until about 6 or 7 years ago. I've been retired about 7 years now. And I saw an ad in a book called The Secret Science of Money by a guy named Zarlinga, and he runs the American Monetary Institute. And so I went to his annual conference in Chicago.
And what's his name, Yanni?
Stephen Zarlinga. Yeah. And this book just blew me away. It was like things about money and how banks work that I had no idea. And I didn't feel too bad about it because once I started talking to people about this, I found out nobody else did either. I've talked to probably hundreds of people about this. I was a lot more enthusiastic several years ago when I first started because I just thought it was the best thing since sliced bread, the reforms that the reformist people had in mind to make a better system involving banking and money. And so I was just like, you know, grabbing people at parties and on the street. And I made a handbill that I handed out at demonstrations. And
I remember that.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think that's what prompted you to ask me on the show, because you remembered me from passing these things out and talking about it. And I found out that nobody knows this stuff. I didn't know it, and nobody else does either. I think I found maybe one person in 100 that could tell me, for instance, how money is created.
And we hear things like the Federal Reserve. I just saw a big documentary on the Federal Reserve on the People's Channel just recently. And it may be old hat to you, but it's really, you know, this person went like you did and, and looked up this stuff. And the whole thing is such a con game. But I
yeah, well, I would have loved to have seen that if I'd have known it was on.
I would have
listened to it, because I'm fascinated with how other people interpret this.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people, and when I say most people, I mean the mainstream media, economist, you know, professional economist and all, they either, I hate to say this, but they either don't know what's really going on, or they've learned in economic schools how to sort of obscure what's
mm-hmm.
really going on.
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot of stuff, you know, in the economics or monetary reform movement. And, you know, most of them are by PhD economists who have taught it all their lives. And they say, many, many of them say that the way economics is taught, and particularly banking, is just horrible. Just horrible. They obscure it. They don't want to talk about it. They actually, I've heard it said more than once from several different sources that they actually will say that the place of money in the economy is not important, the way money's created in the banking system. They just leave it out. They think it's not important. But, of course, the reformists maintain that it's absolutely important. And hopefully I can explain a little bit why that's true. But two of the main things I found out about the money system that really blew my mind was where money comes from, how it's created in the system, and how more of it is created as the economy expands and what have you. And I thought the same thing most people thought that I've asked questions to and all. Sometimes I'll start off a conversation like that. It's like, Where do you think money comes from, and how is it created? And they'll say things like, well, it comes from the government. And I say, well, where do they get it? And they will say, well, through taxes or whatever. But I said, well, how about new money? Well, they just print it. And I go, no. They do print it, but they sell it to the Federal Reserve at cost, you know. And they don't actually, they create the physical money, but physical money is only 2-3% of the entire money supply. All the rest of it is electronic. It's just a byte somewhere on a computer. And they say, well, you know, didn't the Federal Reserve create it? And Federal Reserve is not part of the government.
This is the what. Many of us are confused. Federal Reserve, doesn't that sound like a...
Well, it was given that name on purpose.
I'm sure.
To mislead people.
Surprise, surprise.
The whole Federal Reserve thing was pushed by a bunch of big bankers who must have had some guilty feeling about it, because when they were planning this thing in Jekyll Island in 1912, 1911, sometime before the Act was finally passed in 1913, during the Christmas break, when everybody was gone, by the way, at the very last minute. It wasn't even, most of the people that passed it didn't even understand it, and it was by a very small minority of people. They met secretly to plot this, because they knew that the American public, if they really knew what was going on, would probably not like it. Because up until 1913, banking and money and how the money system worked unlike today, where nobody knows anything about it, was a hot issue. It was a huge political issue in all the presidential campaigns and with a lot of the groups like the Populist and the Farmers League and a lot of the groups that were trying to get reforms to help ordinary working people and farmers.
This is the crucified on a cross of gold business?
Yeah, yeah. William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president in 1896, I think it was. I think he might have run more than once, but I think it was the election of 1896, where at the Democratic Convention he made that speech. And if you want to read a really interesting account of an actual happening, read an account by somebody who was there of that convention. They said that place was just absolutely quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And he gave this speech where he said, I've read it a million times and I can't quote it, but he said, we should not be crucified on a cross of gold. And
trying to get the silver standard? Was it instead?
They were
basic?
Trying to add, we were supposedly on a gold standard at the time, and they were, one of the things that the Popularists and some of the politicians who supported their cause were trying to do during those days, and it's been an issue all through our history, but particularly after the Civil War. They were trying to get silver added to the backing for the money supply, because at that time it was only backed by gold, and since, you know, unless there was a gold rush going on, and, you know, there was, it would it limited the money supply, and there was just not enough money in the system to facilitate commerce, and it had a horrible effect on working people. So they were trying to get silver added, and he ran on that. I mean, can you imagine that being a big issue today? Most people, you know, it's a non-issue.
I can remember when everything except ones in paper money were Federal Reserve notes, and the ones were silver certificates. If
yeah. One thing that, to my undying shame, I have not a good head for figures and facts. I get the general concepts down, but I can't remember in this case what the last time we had silver certificates. I think it was in the 50s, wasn't it? Because I remember as a kid seeing silver certificate on there.
Right. I think that's what it was, and it was definitely the ones. I don't know if it was any other denominations.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
If you look at any paper now, I'm pulling out a $1 bill. It says Federal Reserve Note.
Right.
Which means it's basically the property of the Federal Reserve. And getting back to the Federal Reserve, we kind of got sidetracked there. The Federal Reserve is partially under the control of the federal government, but very loosely. The president can appoint, I think, two or three of their chief board members, and I think, they're seven or nine?
I don't know.
I can't remember the exact number. But the other ones are appointed by the bankers, because the banks that own the Federal Reserve, and it's owned by the member banks of the different regional feds. I think there's, how many, eight, nine? Ours is in Richmond, and there's other regions around the country. And they're private banks. They're absolutely private banks. Their profits that they make are regulated. Supposedly, the Fed itself has to give back any interest that it makes to the federal government, but they're like regulated utilities. They're guaranteed a certain amount of profit to run their organization. When it comes to the regional banks, no way. That's where they make the money. They do not have to reimburse the government for any of the interest. and getting to the main point of what I learned about money that startled me the most is they keep all the interest on all the money they loan, and 97%, remember I said that only 2 to 3% of the money was in physical money. 97% of all money created is created through the Federal Reserve System and its member banks. Now, here's the big question that most people don't understand at all, and I didn't either. I didn't either until about 6 or 7 years ago when I started studying this. Well, I'll ask you guys, see how...
see how naive we are.
Where do you think money comes from? New money, you know, because they're constantly expanding the supply of it because the economy has to expand. And so, where do you think money comes from?
Well, I saw that documentary, but you know, I came in the middle. I'll give that as an excuse, but it seemed to me I remember that the Federal Reserve banks were just churning it out. Now I don't know whether they were doing that graphically to make a point, you know, because they were using a lot of sort of graphics and mm-hmm. other things. So I would just answer then, based on insufficient knowledge, that the Federal Reserve banks print their own money.
Mm-hmm. Well,
my thought was that I heard it somewhere. I couldn't tell you where or who, but that... the money is created basically out of the interest.
Well, that's...
And I'm not sure that that makes any sense, but I remember hearing that.
That's a good guess, and you're getting closer to the real answer because it does involve loans. The answer is that money is created every time a loan is made. New money. Now, what's so startling about this for most people, and as it was for me, is that I always assumed that money came from depositors, that people put money in banks and then the banks loaned it out, but that they only loaned out a certain percentage of their things, that they had to hold a certain amount of it back in reserves. And they call that way of doing things the fractional reserve system. But the reality is, it's almost a myth. They make the loans first, and then they get the reserves. And the way it works is the individual banks within the reserve system that deal with the public and business will make a loan, and then they'll, you know, every day, they're in constant communication with the Central Federal Reserve in Washington, which keeps track of all of these things that are going on. And they just...
print it.
They just... well, they do it electronically. They don't print it because, like I say, only about 3% of money is actual physical money. But they just hit a little keystroke on the computer, and the money comes into existence.
So it's like virtual money. It's not even printed?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's not even printed, but I mean, you know, if you think about it, you know, most people don't use cash these days anyway, so. But the thing that really freaked me out and freaks most people out is that they do it out of thin air.
Right.
They just do it out of thin air. And I thought about it for a while, and it's like, this is the only business in America that gets what they're selling, not by producing it or making any effort whatsoever. They're just doing it out of thin air, you know, mm-hmm. which is a huge privilege because you're making interest on this.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting the principal back, but this is another thing that it really shocked me. As money is created out of thin air, when a loan is made, it's also destroyed when it's paid back. It's, you know,
really?
If you borrow $1,000, you pay back the $1,000, it's gone. So, in other words, our whole money system is completely dependent on new loans being made.
Well, like with the recent crisis in 08, where the government has so much debt, isn't a lot of that debt where the banks are lending the government money?
Well, this is...
This is the part, it's like a sleight of hand
yeah.
that I'm confused with.
Well, this is the really horrendous part, and this is where the monetary reform movement comes in and says, you know, there's a better way to do this that would benefit people other than bankers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only do individuals and businesses have to borrow their money from these institutions, which have been given by legal right. And by the way, that legal right didn't start with the Federal Reserve Act. It merely consolidated it and made it uniform all over the country. That method of creating money goes back to the Middle Ages. It was...
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was formalized... Okay, a little bit of background on how that worked. Back in the old days, precious metals and gold were the main mm-hmm. sources of money. But one of the reasons that economics were fairly primitive back then is they didn't have a really good system for creating money and spreading it around. The way banks got started was that people who did have gold and coins and all, and it was a very small fraction of the population, would go to goldsmiths, because goldsmiths usually had safety boxes mm-hmm. and very well-guarded mm-hmm. situations to keep their gold in. So people thought, well, you know, I'll take my gold and give it to this guy to hold for me. It was basically a holding operation. And what the gold guys found out was that a lot of people didn't come back for their gold for a very long time. So they started lending the gold out to other people and lending it out at interest and getting the gold back. Sounded like a pawn shop, I guess. And then they further figured out that, well, why lend out the gold? Why not just lend out a piece of paper that says, that represents the gold?
Mm-hmm.
And they started lending out way more script or pieces of paper saying that this is worth so much gold than there was actual gold. Of course, we know what happens when everybody decides they want their gold back. It's modern times, it was called a run on the bank, and people used to be hanged in the streets over it because people would get mad when they couldn't get their gold back, and a lot of bankers were killed, or a lot of gold dealers were killed over that. But anyway, it developed into a system where people weren't just gold dealers and gold makers and gold craftsmen anymore. They were bankers. It became formalized in 1694 in Western Europe with the creation of the Bank of England. I don't know how it developed in other countries. I'm sure it was, you know, around that time and thereafter, but I think England was the first country that actually formalized it.
Well, and it used to be, and I'm not sure when that stopped, but Christians considered interest a form of usury,
yeah.
that it was sinful, and that's where the Jewish banks, like
yeah.
the Rothschild or whatever, and I'm not sure what century or
yeah.
what part of, where that came into
definitely one of the earlier Jewish bankers, the Rothschilds,
yeah.
got a little head start on people, and they're now reputed to be, you know, by far the richest family in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how big the Rothschild family is now, but they probably make the Rockefellers look skimpy.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly they started the Rockefeller family by lending them huge amounts of money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the question you asked before about the government having to borrow it, the government, indeed, just like individuals and businesses, borrows their money. There's two main sources of funding government, you know, taxes and borrowing money. Now, they don't borrow it just from banks. They borrow it from, you know, people like me and you who buy savings bonds.
Mm-hmm.
But I think again, my head for figures is not good. But I would take a wild guess and say that probably at least half of the money that they borrow comes from banks. Usually other central banks, like the Central Bank of China, owns the biggest chunk by far. I couldn't give you a figure on that, but and Japan's second, and all the European central banks buy bonds from the government because it's safe. You know, everybody talks about how unstable our system is, but the bonds are still respected. They know they're going to be paid off. But it's kind of a ruse because we are the ultimate people who have to pay, you know,
exactly.
The taxpayers.
Yeah.
We have to pay the payments that they make to these people. Well, what the monetary reform people came up with, and this is what I love about the whole reform movement, they have a relatively simple idea. They say, well, if the banks can do it, why can't the government do it? That is, create money out of thin air. And to take away, you know, to prevent inflation, because if the government was doing it and the banks were doing it, you know, you might get too much money in the system.
Now might be a good time for us to take a break.
All righty.
And get back to find out.
Yeah.
Yes, I want to hear the reform ideas because what's really interesting, the Federal Reserve has been lending money to the banks at what points, 0.1 or something interest, but the banks are charging students. For student loans, it's around 7 or 8% interest, which infuriates me. So let's find out more about that. We're going to take a station break.
Yes. This is WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro, and you're listening to The Wake Up Call, presented by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Triangle Branch. Excuse me. And we are... brought to you over the facilities of WCOMFM.org, which is where you can go if you want to stream live over your computer, or you can tune in the neighborhood environs near Carrboro. You can tune in 103.5 FM. And... we are underwritten by Internationalist Bookstore and Community Center, which is at 101 Lloyd Street in Carrboro. For those of you looking for the Internationalist at 405 West Franklin, it ain't there no more. They have a nice new facility over here in Carrboro.
That we can see right from our window.
That's right.
Just about.
Yeah, we can see the side of the building right diagonally over on Lloyd Street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, do you have any announcements?
No, I was going to ask you, did we have any announcements? Well, a lot of people, a lot of you, Dick, and a lot of our friends are heading by car, by train, by bus. By plane to Selma. For the 50th anniversary of the Bloody Sunday March in Selma. Dick, you want to say anything about that? Or
Mainly that I'm sure there will be celebrations locally all over the place. And
there'll be thousands there.
Yeah.
This is a really, really big moment. And it's especially... heartbreaking right now because the March on Selma was for voting rights, and just in the last few years we're taking a U-turn backwards, and voting rights are again under threat, particularly in the southern states. Surprise, surprise, but could be anywhere. And doing the updated version of the poll tax, having to have all kinds of identification and other things, so making it harder for people who had been in prison, and even though they've paid all their debt to society, some states are still making it hard to be able to vote, although you should be able to. In most of the Western democracies, you can vote even when you're in prison. You do not lose your voting rights. And we are much harsher in many, many ways, but that's for another show. Yes. But anyhow, this is a positive thing that thousands of people will be converging from all over the country to celebrate those brave, brave people who marched across the Pettus Bridge.
Right, and they're actually going to do it more than once because, as you all should know, it didn't actually complete crossing the bridge the first time.
No.
That's when they got beat up and arrested and hosed and attacked by dogs and whatever.
Yeah. And the second time they decided not to because Martin Luther King thought, you know, there would be too much violence. So
right.
They didn't really make it until the third time. All right.
So, yeah, so this, see the movie Selma to see a really beautiful reenactment of that historic time, and so many, Dick and many of our friends will be there.
Yeah.
So I guess that's our biggest.
That's our big announcement. So keep your eyes out for announcements locally of celebrations for those who can't make the trip.
Right. And next week on the 11th, we're going to have Altha Cravey, is it? She's a, this is about the Board of Governors also doing a U-turn and bringing the university back to the time of the speaker ban law, trying to get rid of some important centers.
Right. In particular, one for poverty and
work and
work poverty and maybe
work poverty and yeah. And
here,
also
Nancy,
these,
and then there's two others, one at Central and one at East Carolina.
And they're also have their the civil rights one in their sights under threat. So next week we're going to be having a show about that.
And significantly, the third one is about voting rights. I think, of course, the same people who are trying to make it harder to vote wanted to get rid of that one too.
Right.
Jeez. So I guess that's it. This is Dick Paddock and Lori Hoyt, and we have our guest today, Michael Wade.
Just a quick mention of North Carolina Policy Watch's program, Chris Fitzsimons bringing news and views at 6 o'clock.
Right. Yes. Stay tuned right after us. Don't turn off your dial. It keeps getting better and better. And we're talking with Michael Wade today about a topic that they call it the dismal science. So many of us have shied away from knowing much about it. And, of course, when people don't know a lot about something, those who are kind of unscrupulous take advantage of our ignorance. And so we're talking Wade. Michael has been arming himself with information for some years now. And I think ever since the 08 depression / recession, I think many of us are paying much more attention to economics than we may have before, to our detriment. So the show today is trying to let us know how much we don't know in a way and point us in some directions that it would behoove us to learn more.
Well, I think the solutions are so important, and it's one of my biggest gripes with leftist and progressive politics in general is they have great analysis, great critique. They can moan and groan all day long about how bad things are, but they rarely have any really exciting, positive solutions to it that are well thought out. And
I'll disagree with that, but keep going.
We try. Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about Moral Mondays and Reverend Barber trying to build a movement. But I understand your critique in general.
Well, but even then, I guess in certain issues like, voting rights, all as you can really say is that, like, these things are bad and we shouldn't have them, because a lot of times just getting rid of the obstructions are what you need. But when it comes to money, it's a little different thing because, you know, specific structural changes will have to be made before things will be good. It's not just a matter of you know, removing obstructions. Certain people think that's true, like Ron Paul and the Libertarians. You know, their salient cry is, you know, get rid of the Fed, get rid of the Fed. But they have no idea about how to replace it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of bad things about the way the Fed is run, but to just get rid of it, I've never seen anything that they put out explaining how the whole money situation would work without it.
Mm-hmm.
I just say get rid of it. And, you know, I'm partially in agreement with them because they see it as a special privilege that the banking industry has been given.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't think it's right. But these same libertarians would probably be appalled with with my next proposal I'm going to make, which is getting back to what the reformists say is the way that it should be run. Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, they say, you know, you can say it in three words, nationalize the Fed. Keep the Fed, but make it truly federal. Have it run by the government for the benefit of the vast majority of people and not the banking industry. The same people, the American Monetary Institute, which were putting on the conference I went to several years ago, have actually got a bill in Congress. I don't know whether it's still in there. I'm not sure how those things work. It was proposed by Dennis Kucinich, and I'm thinking just because he's gone doesn't mean that it's not still up for...
Right, somebody else could have picked it up.
Yeah, so I think somebody else picked it up. It was originally called the American Monetary Act. Now it's called the National Defense of Employment Act or something that it doesn't...
Quite.
You know,
yeah,
it's kind of a weird name that they came up with. I think it's because, you know, they like the words national and defense and employment and anything.
Right.
Because it sounds good. But I think it's Bill 2990 in the House of Representatives. Again, I could be wrong about that. But if you look up the AmericanMonetaryInstitute.org, AMI.org, I think it goes by its acronym, you can see what that bill is. Basically, they propose that the Federal Reserve be put under the control of the Treasury and given the power to create money so that we could fund government for free. We could just create money out of thin air and fund the government in place of
the banks creating it, the government have to borrow from the banks. And
well,
isn't that how we're doing it?
Yeah, right now we're borrowing it from the public and banks and we're doing it through taxation. So this would eliminate the need to sell any bonds. No more bonds. In fact, you could create the money out of nothing and as the national debt came due, just pay it off. Well, of course, the main objection to this is people just, their hair gets on fire. I mean, even my liberal and progressive friends, oh my God, that would be inflationary. And it's like, well, no, not really, at least in the case of the federal debt, because the federal debt is in the form of these bonds that they sell. Well, they're traded every day on Wall Street as if they were money.
Mm-hmm.
If you monetarize them, in other words, bought the people out, when they come due, you know, it might be destabilizing if you paid off, what is it, $17 trillion all at once. You know, it wouldn't add any money to the system because the bonds are being traded as if they're money. And most people who own those bonds are banks and rich people. They're not going to go out and go on a spending spree. It's spending on consumer items and all that is one of the main causes of inflation. They would just reinvest it somewhere else, so no problem there. This is what the monetary reform people say, and I agree with them. It's the fears of inflation, I think, are largely bank propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
we've been threatened with inflation for the last 6 years.
Yeah, and there's none.
There isn't any.
Yeah,
right.
The quantitative easing, you know, they've given or loaned. I'm not that's another thing I'm not clear on, because you read different sources and they say different things. It's really maddening. It's like, does anybody really know what's going on here?
Yeah.
I think for the most part, what was the debt at the beginning before they made that first thing in 07 or 08? I think it was only like $4 trillion. It was not that much.
Right, but no, it was at least five, I'm pretty
five?
Sure.
Five? Okay.
Yeah, thanks to Bush.
Yeah.
He cranked it
but
up.
They've given, you know, they've given or loaned the vast majority of the current debt within that time period.
Right.
Which is, you know, at least $12 trillion. And there's a lot of controversy about that. A lot of people put the figure at 11 or 12 trillion since 08. A lot of people say it's way higher than that. I've seen figures of 18, 21, 26, 30, you know, and they say that they're hiding a lot of it. I have seen too many contradictory figures to say whether that's true, but most people agree that it's at least 11 or 12 trillion, because I think the current
added
debt,
yes.
Yeah, 11 or 12 trillion added on top of what we had in 2008.
I thought that we were bringing the debt down.
Well,
no, we're bringing,
maybe a little
bringing
bit.
The annual contribution to the increase of the debt. We're bringing that down because the deficit is decreasing.
The deficit. So the deficit is not the debt.
Right.
Well,
the deficit.
Just give me,
the
just
deficit
let me get out
is
of this
the
conversation in the middle of
is
my
the
head.
Difference between the government budget and the tax. I get confused
right.
about that sometimes myself.
Thank
it's,
you.
It's the difference between what we bring in taxes and what we're spending.
Okay.
And that's what's covered by bonds.
Right.
I'm not sure how that's being brought down. It's being brought down by an insignificant amount. It's not having any particularly positive effect on the economy.
Oh, wow. So that's not the debt itself, the deficit. Oh, my goodness.
But the debt, this is another thing I think people like Ron Paul and the libertarians get it wrong. They've been screaming more than anybody else, but, you know, mainstream critics have also talked about, you know, this quantitative easing, giving all the banks all this money and printing money, they call it just cranking out money, is going to produce inflation. Well, it absolutely hasn't. And the reason for that is that it's not getting into the economy. If it was getting into the working economy, it might be producing inflation, but it would also be producing jobs, perhaps, and, you know, the ability of people to borrow money and all. But basically what the banks are doing is just sitting on it. It's part of their, quote, reserves. So if it's just sitting in a bank, how can it possibly produce inflation? You know, you can't
–
inflation is just an excessive increase in prices. And the old bugaboo about that is that, you know, inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. That's the most common phrase, you know, you hear from people when you ask them to explain what they think inflation is.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where I'll fault the schools of economics. You know, there's a classic algebraic formula, and I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it basically says that if you increase the money supply and don't change any of the other factors in the formula, namely production and all, that you'll get inflation. Well, you know, what business or what store just raises their prices when they get indicators that there's more money in the system? Not many people. What they usually do is just produce more goods so they can sell more goods.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it would be foolish to just automatically raise your prices, because you're in competition with a lot of other people. So it's a lot easier to raise your production rate. Mm-hmm. Economic schools don't even consider that a factor. They just assume that, I mean, it's just mind-blowing that they would look at it that way. Because mm-hmm. that's a real-world phenomena that goes on, you know. Usually when there's more demand, people produce, you know. Now, you can't do that with certain things, like land, but that gets me to another thing that I wanted to explain, which is what I consider to be the real causes of inflation over time is not so much too much money. There's generally too little money in the economy, or else why would you have so much poverty? You know, why would you have so much unemployment? There's not enough money going around. You know, to say that there's inflation because there's too much money is ridiculous. It's how the money is being used, which I think is significant.
Mm-hmm. Or not being used, as you say.
Well, two things are going on with money. One, there's a huge inequality gap. So a huge amount of the money is not going to, it's not being spread around amongst people, and it's not producing employment, and it's not increasing production. It's going into buying assets. I saw a study when I was in my I research this stuff all the time. I'm constantly reading books and looking on the internet, and I found a really interesting statistic. They looked at all the money available for investment in the system, and they found that only 5 to 10%, it may even be on the lower part of that, was being put into productive capacities, you know, producing more goods and services and creating jobs. All the rest of it was being put into the stock market, real estate, derivatives, all this stuff. So it's like, and those things are inflationary. You know, one of the biggest costs for anybody is their home or the place they do business, which they usually rent or they're buying it. So when rich people don't have enough to invest in and there's not enough demand to put it into productive investments, they put it into, you know, fixed assets. Like I say, stock market. So it's great if you've got stocks, it runs the stock price up. But it also runs up, you know, the price of homes because mm-hmm. a lot of homes, a lot of the market is built on speculation. It's mm-hmm. not people actually living in their homes. And just useless stuff like the derivatives markets, which I'm not even going to attempt to explain.
With art, the inflated prices for art, and now they sort of roam around the world looking for any undeveloped place to start mining, and you know it's.
But there's two other causes for inflation, and one of them is more pertinent to what we're talking about here, is interest. You think about it. You loan out, you create $1,000, you loan out $1,000, but you're asking 5% interest. Well, where does that interest come from? A lot of people maintain that, you know, there's arguments within the monetary reform movement even. Some people say it's a bugaboo that you're not producing enough. Since you're not producing originally the interest to pay it back, there's always a constant shortage of money in the system. I'm kind of halfway on the fence on that one because I think a lot of if the interest was getting back to the public, then, you know, you would have the interest over time because it's an overlapping thing. It's going through time. But a lot of that money is just being used as bank reserves or being put into assets, which, like we said, mm-hmm. just creates prices.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people don't know is that that is one of the secret, and you never hear this talked about. It's one of the main drivers of inflation is the interest, because think about it. All businesses have to have space to run their business, either a factory or a store or some kind of production facility. A lot of those people depend on bank loans to keep their businesses going. Business debt in this country is huge. It's trillions and trillions of dollars. of course, they're going to pass on the price of this interest to the public. And the higher the interest rates are, the more they do. There was an interesting study done in Germany back in the 80s, I think. And I would like to see more studies like this because, you know, you're a little wary of basing something on just one study, but it seemed pretty sound, and it was quoted in a book by a woman named Marguerite Kennedy. And I forget the name of her book, but basically what they found is that interest in all through the economy accounts for anywhere from 30 to 50% of the cost of everything. Mm-hmm. That's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, if you took away interest and had public banks, which I'm going to mention really quickly because that's the second part of this reform after nationalizing the Fed, if you had really low interest loans or even interest-free loans, you'd cut out a huge cause for inflation in society, because all that stuff is just, you're not producing anything with interest. It's just going to bankers who are producing their stuff out of thin air. So, you know, it's like a waste. it's ridiculous. So those are the bigger causes of inflation. The third one I was going to mention really quickly is the military-industrial complex.
Mm.
And this is particularly pertinent to the Women's League for Peace and Freedom because, you know, you're anti-war, as any sensible person should be. And when you're producing goods that aren't circulating in society as consumer goods, it's just, you know, it doesn't take much thought to realize that that's inflationary also.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're producing goods that are either going to be destroyed or they're just going to sit there or they're going to be recycled once they're obsolete, like the jet planes and what have you. You know, they're not really circulating and producing that multiplier effect in the economy, which spreads the money around. Of course, the wages are being given to, you know, people that work in the military-industrial complex, and that circulates around. But the goods that they're producing are not really doing anybody
any good. Wages for the military, a lot of them, except for the higher-ups, are so small that they're on food stamps.
It's ridiculous.
So it's not coming to the general military.
But then their favorite dealers are, and this is part of the inflationary thing about military spending, usually it's, you know, they're not really that competitive, or even if they are, there's huge amounts of fraud and corruption. Everybody's heard about the $600 toilet seats and the $350 wrenches that the government paid for, and, you know, that little scandal kind of went away and nobody talked about it anymore, but I'm absolutely sure that it's still going on. You know, that's inflationary. It's just ridiculous. But the second part of the monetary reform is, well, I might explain that the people that say we should nationalize the Fed and create money out of nothing for the government and replace the sale of bonds also say that that privilege of creating money out of thin air should be taken away from the banks, that they should have
Absolutely.
What they call 100% reserves, and that, you know, they can only lend out money that they have. Well, I haven't seen anybody come up with a plan that wouldn't basically destroy the private banking industry, especially if you had a public banks lending out money at 0 to 1%. But basically they would have to, you know, A, it would get rid of a lot of useless speculation and derivative stuff because nobody wants their deposits being used for that kind of thing. So they'd have to be really tight with what they're doing with their money. But, you know, I think they should. And this is a controversy. The American Monetary Institute says, oh, no, that's infringing on private enterprise. You shouldn't do it. But other people, including Ellen Brown, and I must mention Ellen Brown and her book, The Web of Debt.
Oh, yeah. I've heard.
For anybody who wants
Free
to understand.
Free Press had a good, months ago, had a good article about her.
Yeah, she's in the Free Press
yeah.
often. But read her book. I would highly recommend it. She's also the head of the Public Banking Institute, and she came out with a second book which talks about public banks. But the first one will really open your eyes about the whole history.
And what's the name of the first one again?
The Web of Debt.
The Web of Debt.
I would recommend it to anybody. It's aimed at people who don't have a specialized education in economics.
Mm-hmm.
It does get into a lot of stuff, and I don't claim to understand it. I don't like the derivatives. The second book was Zarlinga's book, The Secret Science of Money. A website that I think is good because it's got a real academic background to it is neweconomicperspectives.com or .org, I'm not sure, which New Economic Perspectives. These are a bunch of people at the University of Kansas or University of Missouri, I think, in Kansas City. And they've got the academic backing for all this. But basically the idea of public banks is that because they would be nonprofit, they could loan out, you know, you could get a house loan for like anywhere from 0 to 1%. This would be a huge benefit for most people because everybody would like to own a house. And, you know, if you pay just 6%, which is a little higher than it is right now, you're paying double. You're paying over half of what the original sticker price for that house is. Why should banks be given the privilege to charge that much?
Right. We're down to about 3 minutes left, so if you can...
New Economic Perspectives. Yeah. Let's say that again.
New Economic Perspectives. It's either .com or .org. I'm not sure which.
And Alan Brown's book, The Web of Debt.
Yes, The Web of Debt.
The Web of Debt.
Yeah. And her new book, which is... I forget the name of it. I'm a bigger fan.
But I guess you just of the first one, Ellen Brown, and you.
Yeah, Ellen Brown,
and
the two main stays of monetary reform is to nationalize the Fed, have the government create their own. Well, a lot of people say you could even eliminate income taxes for anybody that made. This is just my idea. I think you could eliminate income taxes altogether, and property taxes. And only tax the super rich, fund government primarily through just freely created money, and the other part of that of the reform would be to create public banks to give out cheap loans to people that need them. Have to mention this one. You mentioned student debt before. I think they should cancel all those debts.
Oh, gee, yes.
The government should pay off all of those debts. They should pay off all medical debts. They should forgive all foreign debts to poor countries. There's just so many things you could do. You could create millions of jobs if you could just the government could create their own money. Well, you could double Social Security. You could make education free, medicine free, child care free. Just create the money. It won't be inflationary because you're producing the goods and services with the money. You're not... Yeah. Just giving out money and not increasing the goods and services.
Because the student debt is higher now than the credit card debt. And the young are not going to be able to – all the things that keeps the economy going, buy houses, you're furnishing the house, all these things, they're it's like serfdom.
And the debts you don't forgive, I think they should, once you get these public banks up and running – refinance everything so you'd cover all the people who are already in debt.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to tie it up now.
Yeah.
Pretty close to being out of time. Something that I hadn't mentioned was internationalistbooks.org for the website of Internationalist Books.
Oh, the website.
And
okay.
The Triangle Wilf, triangle WILPF.org.
Yes.
I did manage to get in. WCOMFM.org.
That's Dick Paddock speaking, and I'm Lori Hoyt, and our guest today
has been Michael Wade.
Anyhow, go ahead.
It's it